Hey everybody, this is Sandra. Welcome to show number 19 of Toon Talks podcast. I'm so thrilled and honored that Pete took the time out to talk to me. He's one of the loveliest and inspiring people in animation with an incredible career. You can see in his student films a natural talent and love for storytelling, and so it's no surprise that Pete was hired one day after finishing college at the age of 21 when he started working for Pixar. He was the animation supervisor on Toy Story, storyboard artist on A Bug's Life, he'd done story treatment for Wall-E, and his directorial debut was with Monsters, Inc. He's been involved in some way, shape or form with all of our favourite Pixar films. His most recent film, the highly anticipated Inside Out, in which he plays the voice of the father's emotion, anger, is due out this June. Pete is someone whose work I've admired for so long. Mark Oftedal used to make me study his shots when I was an animation mentor with him thoroughly, and so it really was a pleasure to have him on the show and finally get to meet him, albeit virtually. This podcast is with huge thanks again to my good friend and mentor Mark Oftedal for writing to Pete on my behalf, and I really appreciate Pixar's openness in letting me have time with him and their other animators and allowing me to share those conversations with you guys. I know you're all going to love this one just as much as me. Enjoy.
How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So you know Mark, huh?
I do. I've known him for a few years now. He was my mentor at Animation Mentor, and then I stalked him ever since.
He's a good guy to keep track of.
Yeah, he's really, really sweet. He's very sweet. He mentored me personally there for about 6 months, and just through Skype, because he's lovely. He's so sweet. And due to him, then I ended up getting a job at Sony.
So where you are now?
I'm starting there next week.
Wow, congrats.
Thank you. But yeah, I have to credit him completely with that one, though he'll say it was all me. Couldn't have done it without him. So there you go.
Well, maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Maybe. So I know we only have 45 minutes, so maybe we can just dive right in if that's not too rude.
Sounds good.
Super. So maybe we can start off with a little bit of backstory, because I know that you started doing some flip books when you were 8 years old, and I'm wondering how the love for animation started for you.
Yeah, I guess for me, you know, like there's all those kids that sit and draw dragons and monsters and horses. Horses were really tough when you're a kid to draw. I could never draw any of that stuff, and it frustrated the heck out of me until I figured out flipbooks, and then the idea of movement was so attractive that I didn't have to draw it that well to still get a rush out of it, you know?
Yeah.
And so then as I got into it and you learn more, you're like, oh, people laugh at certain things, and I started tailoring my flipbooks to have gags and expression changes and things like that that people seem to respond to. So in a way, they were like little short films, I guess.
Yeah. Did you ever record any of them that like we could see?
Well, the thing that so this is like in third, fourth grade, and I've always loved film. My dad had a Super 8 film projector, you know, and I thought, boy, if I film this flip book, if I put it under the camera and flip through it, maybe I could. So I tried that, and then I did one frame at a time, and I would just go, tick, you know, use the shutter as quick as I could. So almost just by trial and error, I kind of discovered how animation works, which is, you know, one frame at a time. And I eventually wore out my dad's film camera from the shutter, you know, making all these short films.
Yeah.
So they're somewhere there on film, but I don't know if they're in the basement, actually. I know where they are.
So are we ever going to get them online? No?
No, nobody should see these. They're awful.
That's a pity. But you started at Pixar one day after college, right? So I'm wondering, what was your first day like there?
The first day was in like May 2000. No, sorry, what the heck? 1990.
Yeah.
So the first day I get there, and I remember John Lasseter showing me around the studio pretty quickly, and then he's like, come on, let's go. So he hop in his old Toyota Camry, which had like 300,000 miles on it. He never changed the oil, and he drives me out into the Redwoods. And so it was very important to him to kind of show off the place as much as the studio, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
We threw rocks off a bridge into this water and drove around and stuff. And then he was busy doing something, so he sat me down to watch Andrew Stanton, who had started like 2 months before me, I think. He was working on a commercial for some sort of gum, like a mint gum. So he was animating this ice cube playing a piano, And I just watched him, and I was like trying to figure things out, and I'm writing things down, and he keeps stopping and going, and swearing, you know, just getting really pissed off at the computer, because it's not an intuitive thing when you've drawn your whole life, then sitting in front of a computer and sliding these little things around to make stuff move is really like, what?
Of all the characters you animated, which do you feel you had the most input into creating?
Well, I feel like the characters that I've had the most input in are not actually ones that I animated on, but that I directed. For example, like Joy on this film.
Yeah.
Or Fear. Anger was a big one that I felt like I was able to grab onto pretty early. But, you know, I got to animate on Sully just a little bit. I did the last shot of Monsters, Inc., which is fun.
Nice.
And that shot has kind of a story behind it, too, which I can tell you if you want.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
So my initial pitch was that there's this monster and a little girl that he's stuck with, and it's sort of like 3 men and a baby kind of thing, where he's like, oh, what do I do with this kid? I don't know. And then he eventually falls in love with the kid, and it becomes a real life changer for him.
Yeah.
Which incidentally was kind of going on in my life, in my personal life, because my wife and I had just had our first kid.
Yeah.
And so it was really like, you know, my brain was scrambled. The story was about those two, and the executive said, we don't think that that's really a story that we want to tell. So what if he has a buddy? Mm. And I was like, wait a minute, we just finished Toy Story. You're just trying to have me remake Toy Story, aren't you? So I was kind of resentful about that. But once we kind of got into the story, we were able to prove that there would be some humor and heart to this kid. But then we get to the end of, we're maybe, I think, 75% animated, and we screened the film for an audience the first time.
Yeah.
So it's a recruited audience. They have no idea what they're saying, and, you know, my heart's going, you know, my throat. At the very end, they keep some people around and ask them questions.
Mm.
And one of the questions, I think they sort of routinely ask this, what did you like about the ending? Did you like the ending? And people would say, I wanted to see more. I wanted to see somebody get back together with Boo.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, can't do that. You know, this would be a disaster, because no matter what I put there, it's never going to come close to what people create in their heads,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So I tried to fight that, and one of the executives said, all right, but that last scene better really be awesome. So so I tried to animate it, and I was pretty pleased with the way it came out, but I think it's largely the storytelling that works up to it. So I didn't have to do a ton of super deluxe complicated animation.
That's very modest.
Well, we framed it from like the chest up, right? So all you had to do is kind of puppet him around, so I didn't have to work on light contact and all sorts of, you know, technical stuff. I could just focus on the expressions.
So which character then did you find it hard to relate to?
Well, let's see. Months was a little difficult on Up. And we tried to, I always feel a little distance from him, and maybe that shows up in the film. You know, we always, even if they're villains or what have you, you're always trying to get inside the head of these characters and understand and feel the way they feel. And that was one that I never got that close on. Actually, even Sully was, I know I just answered that as positive, but he was a really difficult guy to get to know.
Yeah.
And I think when we then started work on Monsters University, it reared its head again. You know, we're like, well, who is this guy? What is he all about? What makes him tick?
Mm-hmm.
Mike showed up really quickly. He just was a guy who, you know, because of his one eye, he just seemed like all he cares about is what's right there. The rest of the world goes away.
Yeah.
He's completely 100% here. And then as soon as he starts here, he's like, now it's all over here. Who cares about that other thing? You know, so... He was pretty easy to figure out, and really, actually, it was thanks to Mike that we started to figure out who Sully was, which is actually something that I've heard a lot of people talk about. I know the Muppets. I've read somewhere that they would, when they're auditioning new characters or new puppeteers, they'll often have them play off of existing puppets that they kind of know, and that helps spark kind of a back and forth and establish who these guys are in opposition to each other.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the Muppets, because I know that influenced animation as well, and I was wondering how that came about. I know Doug Sweetlin used to, and probably it was a thing at Pixar that you just bounce around the route. And I was wondering, is that how you related Muppets to the animation? How did that, like, what is that all about?
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of scenes that I sometimes take a look at, like, there's scenes of Fozzie and Kermit in the car, yeah. And the two of them are there in the Muppet movie, and suddenly you'll swear that I just saw Fozzie's expression change, which is, of course, impossible because they're glued on, you know, he can't move. But it's just through the movement that you infer all this.
Yeah.
Oh, and we had this guy come in. He was, I don't know what you, he's a performer, and he would wear these masks, the Balinese masks. And so they'd have these weird expressions like, you know, this strange expressions. Yeah. But just, again, in the movement, the timing of the movements, you would infer all this different information into this same expression. And that always kind of blew me away. Mm. And it really became, in part out of that, and in part because of technology. You know, at the time when we were doing Toy Story, we'd have these stand-ins because the computers were so slow, we couldn't bring the entire Woody model up, where it would just, you'd take like, you know, a minute and a half to go to frame two. So we would have these spheres with more spheres for eyes, and that was about it. And then, you know, a cylinder body and stuff.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any expressions to work with. So we would just always kind of start with the body. Mm. And we figured, okay, if we can make it clear in the movement, then the facial expressions will just be a plus.
Mm. I see. And I know you're a musician as well, and I'm sure that influences you both in terms of timing, but also in terms of texture. And I'm wondering if you can talk about texture and what that means for you.
Well, calling me a musician is being very liberal with the term. But I do play a bunch of instruments, and I grew up in a family that like my sisters are both professional musicians. And so it's really seated back there in my head. And even as I'm timing out scenes, I'll often hear like basically Carl Stalling music going in my head, you know, and that kind of helps me, like, dun, 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 and then I'll time it with the stopwatch and go, yeah, it should be about like that on eights or whatever. And texture, you know, it really comes down to contrast, I think. If you had to simplify all animation and design knowledge to one principle, I think it's contrast. So if you have a lot of fine little rapid textures, then you want to contrast that with like a long, slow something, or vice versa, or, you know, up and down stuff, then you want a flat, or just, it's all about contrast, and that's how you really pay attention to stuff and notice differences. It's just the way our brains are wired.
Yeah, that's true. What creates appeal in a pose for you?
Ooh, that's always a difficult question to answer because it does seem kind of mysterious. But there again, I think it's contrast. And if you have opposition, so obviously, you know, when you get your character straight up out of the computer, you've got like the rod up his spine and he's totally stiff with his arms sticking out.
Yeah.
And then the more you can kind of break that, get curves and oppositions from, say, the hips to the shoulder slope, all these kind of little things just to loosen it up. And then I love, you know, if you look at drawings, I mean, some of the beautiful, most beautiful drawings and wonderful poses just coming to mind are in Pogo, the Walt Kelly strip. And he just gets these, he's got just enough structure in there and enough looseness that, again, about that contrast thing, that it just creates this wonderful, like, you know exactly where the elements should be, the spine and the foot and things, but then it's got this fluidity to it and a looseness. And if you go too far either side, you fall off. You know, if it's too stiff, you have too much structure, then it looks like somebody drew it with like a, you know, dactyl blade or something.
Yeah.
And if you go too loose, then you just kind of have nothing to hold on to. So it's a real art.
Mm. That's true. So how was the transition for you from animating to storytelling to directing and writing?
Well, as a student at CalArts, I had done my own films for 3 years. And actually, even before CalArts, because of the flipbook thing, I started doing my own stuff. And a lot of those were meant to be little stories, or at least a series of gags. Mm. So I felt like I was not well-versed, but at least it was kind of the way my brain worked, that I was always kind of thinking about storytelling, or specifically about how to get a reaction out of the audience.
Mm.
So, you know, because again, there was not like some people find a real joy and a love in drawing, and I wish I felt more of that because I would like to draw more. And but for me, it's always been a little bit of a struggle. Like okay, sit down, I've got to draw. But where the joy comes for me is watching somebody react to something, you know, and getting a rise out of people. So that's kind of where my brain was, even as an animator. So I didn't feel like it was a huge shift. The one thing I will say, I really started feeling almost guilty. Like I don't actually do anything. I am a director. I don't actually draw. I don't write. What do? I don't do anything. I felt like a fraud for quite a while. And then you realize, okay, that is the job of the director, is to go around and infuse, communicate to everyone kind of what information they need. And if you give them too much, it can be confusing. If you give them the wrong information, you can waste weeks worth of time and money. So there's, you know, not a little pressure there. Communicate clearly to people. And be able to take advantage of their enormous talent. You know, if I come in and I felt prey to this on early films, like, okay, on frame 7, if you could move that leg over a little more and really wanting to kind of get in there, almost like reach through them and start to animate a little bit, I think a much better way to work is to hopefully use words that allow the animator to bring their own acting ideas, their own incredible skill to the screen. Yeah. So hopefully, like the way you talk to a voice actor, you know, hopefully you're talking about intention and feeling and emotion, and then let the amazing actors that we have, both with their voice and with their computer, bring it.
Yeah, absolutely. What is the earliest story lesson you remember getting in terms of learning on the job?
Story lesson. Well, I was lucky enough to, at CalArts, have Joe Rampt, story teacher, and he admitted later that he had never taught story before and that it was such a complex thing that it was kind of, he was scratching his head a little bit as to how to communicate some of this stuff. A lot of it just comes through, you know, good observation and doing it a lot. I always thought, like, you know, there's this myth that, like, you're born talented or you're not, right? Mm. Believe, like, oh, well, you have a gift. You were born being able to draw. Well, would you ever expect a kid to pick up a violin and go play Carnegie Hall? I mean, no. We know that it takes practice, right? And I think storytelling, animation, all of this, you think about making a film as a sort of an end. Well, that's sort of like practice, right? For stuff that's going to happen later. I still feel like the movies I do now is kind of practice, and I'm getting better at what I do, and hopefully some areas, thanks to the practice. So, I don't know, lesson in storytelling. I guess one thing while I was at school that kind of blew me away was Glenn Keane came and he showed, first of all, I was in love with anything Disney, and Glenn's drawings were just like, I was in a younger, lower class, and he was there for the upper class, and so we would sit over the balcony and just peek down and drool, you know. Guys downstairs would be like, well, whatever. But he brought in Totoro.
Oh, nice.
And I remember superficially going, oh, it's so stiff, and you know, everything's on eights or something. But when you watch it, people were so engaged because he had captured truth.
Yeah.
And I think for me, like, more than all the stuff that you learn about with plot and act 1, 2, 3, you know, all those kind of things that are important. What he shows is that as long as you have some sort of truth of real life that you can capture and put on the screen, that is really intriguing. Like, as people, we recognize truth and we respond to it and we engage with it.
Yeah, very much so. Is that the story lesson you would like to pass on, or what story lesson would you pass on?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's, to me, like, the truth in character is a big thing. And we were, I've gotten to work with an amazing cast of actors on this show. I was talking with Mindy Kaling, who plays Disgust, and she was mentioning how so much of humor comes from being able to predict, to know it, for the audience to feel as though they know a character well enough, they kind of know how they're going to react, right? And either you deliver it to them, which is somewhat, is kind of satisfying in a way. Or you surprise them and twist and surprise the audience in a way. And that's fun too. So it's pretty cool just thinking of it in terms of that truth, in terms of character, I think. You know, and that's been done in so many amazing Miyazaki films as well as great Disney films through the ages. So,
what do you feel are the most important things you've done to get yourself where you are today?
I was lucky. I worked hard. That's a good question. I was lucky enough to focus on the right things. And maybe in a sense it was lucky that I struggled with drawing because I didn't lean too heavily into that. And in fact, when I started at Pixar, I was kind of like, you mean I don't have to draw? This is great. I can sit there and I can create movement, which is the part I love anyway, without having to struggle over the, why doesn't that look on model? You know, that's very frustrating. So I had a good focus, I guess. But, you know, I can't take too much, like, credit for where I ended up because I never really intended to. It's not like I was 7 going, someday I'm going to be a director, you know.
Yeah.
I just liked making stuff.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a key, is, like, enjoying where you are and what you're doing and trying to find some toehold, even if it's, like, in-betweening snow effects or something, like finding some way to make that enjoyable for yourself.
Right.
So, because I think that ultimately it shows up in the work. I mean, we're all artists, and I think that's by its nature, what you do with your hand is going to be infused with some amount of you, you know, some the joy or the pain you're experiencing in life or the torture that you're going through dealing with your parents or whatever that is, it's going to kind of show up in your work in some way.
Nice.
That one didn't really answer your question at all, but
you did there at the start. You answered it at the start. What was the hardest thing for you to get your head around when you were a first-time director?
I think it was, like I mentioned, the sort of feeling for myself that I wasn't actually doing anything, because I really valued and still do the work. You know, the fact that you're sitting and you're writing, you're crafting something, you're painting. And again, as a director, I felt early on that I wasn't actually doing anything. I mean, since then, now I've taken to writing, not so much because I'm great at it, but because it's a way of getting my ideas down to pass them on and to try to hone what it is that's going on in my head and my heart, I guess. That took a little while to figure out, you know, and what words I need to use, how to approach different people and communicate and build teams up. And, you know, there's a whole, one of the surprising things to me was at school, I always felt like, okay, it's all about skill. If I can draw well and animate smoothly and know all the principles of animation, I'm going to be the top animator in the business. But then you get out there and you realize how much of this is actually people skills, the ability to talk to someone else and listen and respond and use and incorporate those ideas together into something that's better than whatever I had. So I'm not just like, I have the ideas around here. You know, you're using multiple brains to get there.
Yeah.
And those are skills that I just wasn't thinking that those were necessary. It was not something I focused on at school.
What would be the hardest thing for you to get your head around nowadays?
Oh, boy. Yeah, there's a lot of things, but it really all comes back to, like, we were just looking at some scenes, early sequences in the film. It all always comes back to story and communicating, you know. Things that I thought would be clear or entertaining, and then you get it up and you're like, this is lousy, and I don't like this character, and why is that, you know? The hardest thing for me is just getting my head around what makes a character interesting and engaging. And, you know, you try to break it down. It's one thing to, like, you know, give a lecture on it, but then you're sitting there in front of a blank page and either writing or typing or doing whatever, drawing, and where does that come from? You know, I don't know where that comes from. That's a hard thing to, and it's a challenge every time.
Yeah.
Every time you start out, it's like you're back at square one, you know?
Oh, man, there's no hope.
No. No, but that's where, you know, you just keep working. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, Joe Ranft would always say this thing, trust the process, which has been interpreted in a lot of different ways. But I think what it means is, like, where I am right now, it does not have to be perfect. It just has to get me to the next step. Because in the long run, all these steps are going to build on each other, and they're going to make something that's better than any one little bit.
Well, that's giving me back my hope.
Thank you. Okay.
So I'd love to create a short film, and I was wondering what your advice would be on how to go about it. What would a person need to know from the outset?
Here's the number one thing I think people make mistakes with their own. Well, two things. Mm-hmm. I'll probably think of more than that. Okay, the first thing is, people get way too complex.
Yeah.
They want to here's an epic film that takes like a cast of China and all explosions, and even if it's not like a grand thing, they get way too complicated with the story. Mm-hmm. So it's almost impossible to be too simple. Just think that way. And if you really let the audience into the character's head, that is, find ways to express, and it, you know, the obvious would be like a shot, you know, a close-up of their face, and then you can see their thought process. I think I will steal this thing or whatever. You know, you get to see their expressions.
Mm.
That is a real key, because obviously what you want is the audience to relate to your character and empathize with them so that they feel along with your character what's going on. And I think a real key to that is personal experience, which, again, gets talked about a lot, but it's really true. If you can be telling a story from a personal place, it doesn't have to be literal. You know, the case of Monsters or Up, those were both very personal stories. This one, Inside Out, is a very personal story, but, you know, I'm not a monster going to work at Monsters Incorporated. I'm not an old man, and I'm not an emotion. So it's finding these analogies so that on a deeper level you're talking about what it is to be a parent, or, you know, what it is to love someone, and things like that. So so that usually, and I find this is true around here anyway, that when people start out pitching something, they'll say, this story came from my relationship with my mother, or my wife, or, you know, my best friend, whatever it is. So you kind of start thinking about these things that are very impactful emotionally on you. And then usually there's a way to kind of make that now about a story about, you know, a lamp or whatever. but it's a metaphor for something that's deeper.
Yeah. So you guys talked a lot about, and maybe this is like a lesson in keeping things simple, but you guys always talked about how you don't think how you're going to make the movie, you don't think about the technical difficulties of it, but that's a lot more complicated for one animator on their own wanting to make a short film. You can get overwhelmed by all the technicalities that you can't do. So what does the person do in that situation?
Well, I still think this, the basic idea applies, and that is, like, when you're first approaching the film, don't limit yourself needlessly. I think, you know, the more you are familiar with the limitations you have, you don't want to do simulated cloth or whatever it is, that will hopefully just kind of be there in the back of your head.
Yeah.
But something like, I remember on Toy Story, the first one, we had this gag, this is just an example, where Woody was being burned by the magnifying glass on his forehead.
Yeah.
It's just, it's like, and then he gets called out of the room, and Woody's forehead's on fire, and he ran in the first version, in the board version, he ran over and dunked his head in Scud, the dog's bowl of water, which was all gross. And of course, that made a big splash and water effects, which were really hard to do at the time. So we're like, okay, how can we avoid not showing water? Well, we can stage it low. We can make it, instead of water, what if it's like in a whole bowl of Fruit Loops or Cheerios or something? And then that's, you know, that has actually ended up lending itself to further gags where you get the Fruit Loops stuck in his face. So that all ended up like a good example of thinking about the limitations, but at the appropriate time.
Yeah.
Because if you're right off the bat going, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this, then you just shut down and you're like, what can I do? I'm posed, you know. But if you let yourself just think for a while, and then once you have something there, you're probably in a pretty good position to know why it's there and what you need from it. Mm-hmm. And then I can sub it out for something else. Or find a way to stage around it, or be creative.
That's cool.
Yeah.
As a writer and director, your story goes through a lot of changes and influences from other people. And I'm wondering, which of the films you feel you had the most influence into creating the final product?
You know, it's funny. I think every film I work on feels more and more kind of personal to me. And maybe that's distance, because I also, and this is me, I like, once the film's done and all the press is done, I don't really watch them. So they kind of fade off into the distance. And now I'm focused on what am I making now. Yeah. But this one, Inside Out, felt, it is a very personal story to me, and it's close to me.
Yeah.
I think I probably would have said the same about Up, maybe a little less about Monsters, because it was my first one. So a lot of that was like, okay, really needing help from the team and from John and Andrew and Lee and all these amazing filmmakers that I get to work with. That's what, you know, I feel like, man, if you can work in a place where you have great people around you that you can lean on, you have such an incredibly a big leg up.
Mm.
Because the hardest thing as you get into these are objectivity. You get in there, and to me, I'm like, oh, this is brilliant. Oh, oh, it's so emotional. And then you show it to someone else, and they go,
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, oh, okay, back to the drawing board. So you can so easily get tempted, seduced into believing that it's working. So it's nice to have people that will tell you the truth, even when it's not fun to hear.
Mm.
And people who, like I say, who are amazing problem solvers that can help come up with ways to make it work.
Yeah, that's true. So when did you know you had the story for Inside Out? And I'm wondering about earlier iterations that you really connected with but just had to let go of. If you can talk about those.
Yeah, well, the film, which you'll see once it comes out, is a specific story, and it really came from watching my own daughter grow up. And she was, I think, around 9 or so when we did. She did the voice of young Ellie in Up.
Oh, nice.
And so I got to direct her, which was kind of funny. We would just play the copy game where I'd say this, look out, you know, and then she'd parrot it back, and we'd go back and forth until we got something that we liked.
Cute.
Anyway, she was a lot like that character. She was really spunky and spirited. And then as she got older, she started to get more quiet and withdrawn, and I was like, oh no, what's going on in her head? Oh no, what's happening? And because I remembered that time.
Yeah.
You. But for me, growing up was hard, you know, and there was definitely a sense of something being lost. And so we just started playing around with that. And that led us on, you know, that's a pretty big, like, if you imagine a big, you know, we're only audio here, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to not use my hands too much, but like imagine a big giant shovel on the front of a snowplow. It's going to pick up a lot of different ideas, a lot of snow. And so in the end, we had to like narrow that thing down to only pick up the snow we wanted to tell this story. Yeah. So we ended up with a ton of snow on either side of the snowplow that we had to kind of push out of the way in order to get the path laid. Yeah. Boy, this is a weird analogy. Hopefully it makes sense.
It makes sense to me.
Yeah, okay.
It makes sense to everybody else I'm sharing. But what else was I asking you about the Inside Out? Oh, yeah, the earlier iterations on Inside
Out. Oh, yeah. Yeah, sorry, I got off track there.
Okay.
So as we explored those, I guess, you know, it was pretty clear from even the early versions that the story would be told from a parent's point of view, watching their kid. And so Joy, as our main character, is sort of a surrogate parent. And there were a number of different kind of story threads that we chased down that were more analogous to a parent's experience, that being like, I don't want my kid to grow up. I want to hold on to childhood and things like that. And those were stories that felt truthful, but that as we dramatized them, didn't surprise and engage people in the way we thought. You know, maybe because in the back of your head, you always know, well, you can't not grow up, right? That's it's going to happen. So the audience is way ahead, waiting for Joy to finally figure that out.
Mm.
You know, so you know, we had good reasons for heading in there because it felt like it had truth to it and it was emotional to us. But in the long run, we sort of realized it was too much. We couldn't figure out anyway a way to make that play to the audience that felt dramatic, engaging. Which is usually the case. I know, like on Monsters, we had we had a version where Sully was going to be more of a lazy guy, right? That he had scared a kid early on or made a big mistake, I think it was. And so his defense against that was to just be like, I'm going to just sleep at home, you know. And so he was kind of a lazy bum until this kid came along, and that kind of brought him back to life, sort of Casablanca, like every film goes through a Casablanca phase. Start to reference, oh, Rick is dead at the beginning, and then he comes back to life. It's so beautiful. It is cool, but, you know, doesn't apply to every single film.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and a lot of this is just, I don't know any other way, but just to try it out. You have to find ways to get it up in some way, whether that's on a script form or storyboards or even animation, and then be ready to rip it all down again. Because it inevitably doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, what is your advice for coming up with ideas?
There's a couple of tricks that, or not really tricks, but techniques that I'll use. I mean, pretty much, I'm unaware exactly. When people ask me, like, where do you get your ideas? I'm like, I have no idea. They just show up, you know, in my head. And sometimes the first version, when I look back, is actually kind of lame, and then I build on it, and that's kind of one thing. But, you know, Bob Peterson, who I've gotten to work with on a couple things, he's big on making lists, and I've done that too, where you're like, okay, I want to do something with fruit. Okay, so then you just come up with a big, long list of different ideas of how could I use fruit in telling the story, and at first it's hard, but then they start coming, and usually it's like way down the list somewhere, finally that's interesting, you know. So it's not very often that the very first thing, the top of the list, is the best one. It's usually the most obvious or kind of dull or something, and it's only after your brain gets warmed up, kind of like a motor or something, that you start getting the good stuff. So that's one thing. Let's see. Research is huge. You know, if you're starting on something and you kind of know, okay, this is going to be about soccer, you know, hopefully you love soccer to begin with, so you have a big bunch of information. But I think the more research you do on anything, you always come across really cool stuff that you can use. And sometimes it's not obvious, you know, like you'll do research on ants, and instead of learning about the way their joints operate, it'll be some behavior thing. You're like, oh, wait a minute, that's actually thematically exactly what I'm trying to do with this character, da-da-da-da. So you just kind of keeping your brain open and loose and connecting things in unexpected ways.
That's cool. What do you... Oh, you finished there? Sorry, I don't know.
I think so. Maybe some other stuff will come to me, but yeah, go ahead.
Every now and then there's a pause, and I don't know. It's Americanisms. Us Irish people, you can't get a word in edgeways, so when it goes quiet, I'm like, okay,
he's gone. I don't want to just blab. Interrupt me.
What to you is the secret of storytelling?
The secret of storytelling? I have no idea. I think the secret, I guess, is somehow saying something that means something to the audience, you know? Oh, let's see. Who was it? It was, oh, okay. I heard Bob Dylan was talking about he's just done an album of Frank Sinatra tunes, which is kind of bizarre. But he said he loves Frank Sinatra because he always aspired to be like him, in that Frank Sinatra doesn't sing at you. He sings to you. And by that, I mean, I think what he's talking about is the same thing we're talking about. I'm going to make a film not for me, but for the audience. Hopefully it'll fulfill both, but it'll be from a personal place. So I have something that I'm infusing with my own ideas and feelings. But the reason I'm doing it is not for therapy. It's to be able to get a reaction from the audience. So if I'm pouring my heart out and everybody's like checking their watch, then I know it's not working, right? Yeah. I have to go back and find some other way to do it. So I think that's really the secret to storytelling, is speaking from your heart, but for the benefit of other people.
Oh, that's very sweet. What has directing taught you about animation?
Oh, yeah. Directing, I think what it's taught me is how to be a little more direct. And really, it's funny, especially as you work with new animators, and boy, there's some really amazing talent. But a lot of times you'll find that they go slightly askew because they're trying either too many ideas or they're being seduced by the technique or whatever. And so directing and even just communicating to people has really taught me to distill down into as few words as I can, but each one very carefully chosen to communicate that idea of what I need in that scene. And it's also another good thing that it's probably not new to any of your listeners, but thinking about beats, story, kind of beats or phrases in a performance, so that, you know, when you come into a scene, the first beat is about confusion, like, what's going on? I don't understand. And then the second beat is a reaction to, oh, I see this piece of information.
Yeah.
And the third beat is fear, get the heck out of there. So if you can break a scene down into individual beats, then each one of those you can play with, to, you know, thousands of variations on confusion or surprise or or fear. But at least I know where they, what they are, you know, and there's a gauge by which to measure that, the success of it. So when I show it to people and they're like, gee, he looks hot, you know, like, no, he's supposed to be confused, you know, then I know it doesn't work. So there's a lot of little things like that that have been really helpful. And then also being aware of the larger story. I think sometimes as an animator, you fall into living within this scene. And I think every scene, it's like a, you know, a piece of a, what's the thing that, what is that? I'm searching for that kind of weird laser printed thing. It's a hologram.
Oh.
So you know how, like, if you clip a corner of a hologram, you'll still be able to see the whole piece in it.
Yeah.
And it's that same idea with a shot, that somehow even within a shot, you should hopefully be aware of where the character's been and where they're going, so that you have a sense of more than just this character walks in and grabs the glass off the table, you know. You have a sense that it's part of a larger arc for that character.
That's true. What is the most interesting thing anyone has ever said to you about directing?
Well, here's one. Okay, I was talking. I've been lucky enough to, you know, cross paths with some amazing talent folks that I kind of go, if I could go back and talk to my 12-year-old self and say, someday you're going to talk to Frank Oz, I'd be like, what? You know? So yeah, I got to talk to Frank Oz about directing, and he said something that I thought was really very clever and smart. And it's basically, let's see if I can not screw this up. There's nothing riskier than playing it safe, and there's nothing safer than taking risks. So in other words, if you're going to try to just put the scene across in a very sort of normal, pedantic way, the audience is going to be like, what time's dinner, you know? But if you surprise them and take some sort of, even if you screw it up, they're going to be leaning forward going, what's happening? And they're going to be engaged. So don't play it safe. That's a good.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
So outside of your Pixar family, who do you go to for advice?
I've again, been lucky enough to cross paths with some pretty amazing folks. Tom McCarthy, who I got to work with on Up, he is a fantastic filmmaker. I love, you know, The Station Agent, Win-Win, all these films that he does are just spectacular. And so when I'm really stuck, I've a couple times called him up. Sometimes I'll talk to my wife, who at the very beginning, when we first got married and we were working on Toy Story, she was really in tune with everything. And she's a great just outsider. Like, she's not, because I never stopped talking about it, she's learned a lot about animation and storytelling and things like that. But otherwise, she's into normal things like, you know, kids and school and stuff.
Normal things.
So, yeah. So she's a good person to kind of bounce things off of and see, does this make sense? Do you understand why I'm saying this? And so that's really helpful.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
So since I'm starting out in a new feature, I'm wondering, for other animators new to feature level, what can they do to build up speed and get up to the level of other animators on the team?
Oh, boy. Yeah, building up speed, that's pretty key. Because if you're fast, you can make, you can try a lot of stuff. You can allow yourself to make mistakes, which is a huge one. If you're coming in with the idea like I'm going to do this perfect, it's a little bit like what Frank was talking about, you know, playing it safe.
Yeah.
You have to allow for yourself a certain percentage of what you do is going to be wrong, and that's okay. And if you don't make mistakes, I think you have to kind of step back and go, gee, am I taking enough risks here? Am I really trying new stuff? You know, if people aren't once in a while telling you that just doesn't work at all, then you know, you're probably screwing up in an unexpected weird way by playing it too safe.
Yeah,
but that's not to do with speed. That's just to kind of allowing yourself. I think I would expect, at least I know this was true for me, that you're going to spend a lot more time than you might want sitting at your desk. You know, maybe you, hopefully you want to. I know I do.
Yeah, of course. Why wouldn't you?
You just get there. You're like, do I really have to eat or can I sit here? You know, because you're just so into it.
Animation is food.
Food, yeah. But the more you can just keep working and kind of muscle memory, teaching yourself shortcuts and tricks and things like that, you know, it might seem kind of cheap, but like I say, if you're able to do things quick, you can try something, show it to somebody, it didn't work. You just, you know, delete the whole thing and you feel like, well, yeah, but I can get something else quick. So,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend this for just starting out, but I was talking to Tony Ficilli, who's an amazing animator, and he was mentioning, this is not starting out, this is maybe, I think he was mentioning it like on Lion King, so he'd been working in the field for a while, and he said, sometimes, this has more to do with simplicity, I think. He said he would purposely wait until the very last minute, even to start on a scene. This shocked me and scared the hell out of me today. He would wait, like he knew he had a review with the director at 5 o'clock on Friday, and he would purposely wait until 3 o'clock on Friday start the
clock. Oh, my God.
And then, with only 2 hours, all the fear, he would channel that and there was directness and a simplicity to his drawings where he's not going to noodle and get stuck in the way an earlobe looks or whatever. It's just like, okay, I only have time to draw the basic idea of this. Here's the next drawing and just flip, and then... So because you limited yourself purposely, he felt like it made him, forced him to make better choices.
Yeah, I can see how that would, but maybe not starting out.
Yeah, no.
I don't think
the only way you can get away with that is if you got the stuff, you know?
Yeah, so. You got the practice, and I don't think I could do that in 2 hours. I'd be,
No, I know.
Well, what about young animators finding their own voice? What advice would you have to go about doing that?
Yeah. I think that's really key because nobody really wants to, let me put it in a positive way. People want you for you. They want you to bring something. You know, there's a great story that Kristen, I've forgotten her last name, she's a story artist on Dory right now. Anyway, she was telling us that she applied here 6 times and she kept saying, okay, what does Pixar want? And they need draftsmanship, they want staging, they want all these things, composition. So she put these portfolios together thinking this is what Pixar is looking for. And then she'd get rejected. And then the last time somebody asked her, hey, you know, you should apply. And she's like, all right, you know what? I'm just going to put whatever I want in because they're going to say no anyway. So she put all these cartoons about her own personal life and jokes that, you know, observations, the refrigerator stinking and stuff like that. And she got hired because people felt, hey, there's a person with a unique point of view and something to say. And regardless of her composition skills or whatever, I think actually those were probably pretty good too. but she had something unique to say and that's what got her the gig. So, you know, and I know that's true for as a director. Speaking as a director, I'm hoping and praying that whenever I give something to someone, they're not going to just do what I tell them.
Yeah.
You know, they're gonna plus it. They're gonna bring extra goodness and personal experience. Yeah, Kristen Lester, her last name, and so that I thought that was a really inspiring story.
Yeah,
because that's what you're looking for, which really only comes from doing personal work. You know, get out there with your sketchbook. Take notes at parties, your family gatherings, memories, I think, is a good thing to draw from, with like what happened to you as you're growing up, or You know, the equivalent of like journaling, I guess, is kind of just keep exercising your own brain so that that part of it stays going, as well as the sort of collaborative, you know, production ends of things.
Yeah, that's very encouraging.
Yeah.
Well, what advice would you have for, sorry, did you need to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't think I do enough of that now. I'm lucky, I'm fortunate in that I get to do that kind of through the projects I'm directing.
Yeah.
But I need to draw more.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because you do Christmas animations or something, I heard before.
Yeah, Mark probably told you, I do these flipbooks every Christmas, and, you know, I'm usually just rusty enough to go like, really frustrated. And then by the end, when I'm finished, I'm like, yeah, okay, let's do another one at a time.
Yeah.
So these kind of semi-autobiographical flipbooks of things that have happened that year, hopefully somewhat Christmas related, although not sometimes it's not about my kids growing up or the dog died or getting a Christmas tree or whatever, and trying to have fun with it. So there's a lot of jumping and hopping around because I like animating jumping. finding an excuse for that.
Nice. Very sweet. I was wondering, what was your advice for longevity in the industry?
If you love what you do, you're always going to find, I don't know, maybe that's oversimplifying it. I like to think you're always going to find a place for yourself. I'm not sure if that's really the nature of your question. Let me just talk around that for a minute. So, yeah, if you're just phoning it in, it's going to show up in the work. You have to find a way to love it. And I think if you all are always hungry to do something, even if it's like, I didn't really come here to, you know, Xerox papers or whatever, but okay, if that's part of the job, then I'm happy to do it and help out.
Yeah.
I think, like we were talking about before, sort of, ability to communicate and work with people in a good way is really gonna pay off in the long run. And I think too, like having a balance so that you don't burn yourself out. I have seen that too, where people just work so hard and so fast, and they're so into like climbing the ladder and whatever, and even just doing great work, that they end up fried. So you know, it's important to have time every so often for yourself to try new stuff, to do something that is completely unrelated to work.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can borrow from that too, the energy that you get from some new project. You're like, oh, I can't wait to get back to that. But I know right now I'm animating on this production shot. Yeah. I can kind of borrow some of the enthusiasm for this and put it to there, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's kind of discouraging for me though when I see really amazing older animators that get laid off.
And yeah, I know.
That's kind of tough for a young person to, especially if you feel like you're probably taking somebody else's position, you know?
Yeah.
It's a circle of life, I suppose, but that's a really horrible thing. You know, somebody's going to be coming up the peg line behind you too, yeah. You know, at some point.
The encouraging thing for me is like, you look at Frank and Ollie in their later years, and I feel like they were doing some of the best work of their life, you know, in their 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Then there are negative examples of that too, like Freddie Moore or whoever, who you know, were amazing coming right out of the chute and then didn't stay hungry or learning and whatever. I don't know if that's like a brain thing, like they were wired that way, or maybe it's a point of view.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I kind of choose to believe it's a point of view that we have control over it. That if you stay focused in the right way and curious, and curiosity is a big thing. As soon as you feel like, yeah, I know this, I know how to do this, then you're going to get bored and it's going to show up in the work.
Yeah.
And eventually somebody new that's more curious than you is going to come up with. Because the other, and this is cool for you guys who are just starting, I look at the level of talent out there and it's intimidating.
Yeah, it's encouraging in one way, but it's also, because they're your peers and you get to learn from them, but it's also intimidating. So,
definitely. But there's so you know, coming right out of school, you have enthusiasm and all the benefits of the modern world of being able to reference anything you want. You can look it up on YouTube and study it right there.
Yeah.
You know, that was stuff that we didn't have. However, as you gain experience, that's a positive too, and so you lean on that a little bit.
Yeah.
things that I know are going to work or not work, and little tricks that I learned and apply in different ways. So, you know, there's benefits and disadvantages to every stage, I think.
That's true. That's
yeah. True.
What to you are the makings of a great animator?
I think a great animator is, first of all, kind of going back to what we started with, an amazing observer of life. Mm. And if there is a curiosity and a continual seeking for detail and nuance, and specifically like human behavior, the way people act and why, you know. Actually, I think Darwin would have made a great animator, because if you ever read any of his stuff, and it's tough for me to slog through it because it's pretty thick, but that guy watched everything. You know, he understood early on, like, there are some combination of muscles that my one-year-old doesn't use. And so that never occurred to me, but he made a whole study of facial expressions, having not really been trained or anything in that, because there was no such study at the time, but he just was always kind of observing everything and looking for details and nuances. And I think that is something that animators need, because otherwise you fall back into cliches. You know, I think cliches are basically things that people have used too many times. Mm. There's tons of this, infinite numbers of new variations and details out there to be used in your work, and if you're keyed into it, they're there for your use, for the taking.
Yeah, that's a tricky thing I find, fighting cliches. Mark, when he was teaching me, he would make me do the same exercise 3 or 4 different ways every time, and in the early stages it was so hard. I was crying at one point. I was like, I can't do it. But then eventually I got it, and it was like, he would tell me there's thousands of ways of doing this, like just jumping a box across the screen, and I'm like, there's not, Mark, there's like 2, you know? But eventually I was like, oh my God, there really is thousands of countless ways of doing it. So it's like...
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to the list-making thing that we were talking about. Mm. Same kind of idea.
Just doing it and going through the painful process.
Yeah.
Perhaps, what is the greatest piece of advice anybody ever gave you, and who is it from?
I know as soon as we hang up, I'm going to have 3 or 4 things. The one thing that's coming to mind right now, I was, as a student, I wrote to Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson individually, and they wrote back, and I asked them some, like, what does it take to be an animator? And they went through all the different things of, wait a minute, this is not going to be helpful. Well, I'll finish the story anyway. I can answer it properly. But I remember him saying, this was Frank Thomas saying, like, good draftsmanship is a must, and, you know, observation and really a knowledge of people and what makes them tick and things. And he said, as with most things in life, good luck plays a big part of it. Okay, well, that's true, because, you know, there are a lot of other people that I went to school with that I think, man, these guys were super talented, and why are they not, you know, directing their own features or whatever. And I think some of that is just being in the right place, but then also, you know, having the necessary skills or whatever to be able to take advantage of that situation.
Yeah.
All right, so that was a little side note story. An amusing anecdote about Frank Thomas. The best advice I ever got, nothing's still coming to me other than just keep doing it, you know. I think, oh, that's one. Okay, so I got to talk to Charles Schulz once.
Nice.
And I grew up loving Peanuts comics, and they're still, they're amazing, because and really unusual in that they speak to kids and adults and all these different levels, you know. It's so wonderful. And I asked him, like, what do you do when you get stuck? And he's like, I don't let myself. You just keep working.
Yeah.
And eventually, what you think of as being stuck is you just push through it.
Yeah.
And for me, I know, you know, I just kind of mentioned Tony's thing. He had an interesting, he said when he's having trouble getting going on a scene, he will sometimes allow himself over the course of the day. He said, I wish I knew this as a student. He said, I'll say, okay, this hour I get to go goof off and talk to people the whole hour. I just have to work for 5 minutes. That's all I need, 5 minutes of work.
Okay.
The next hour, same thing. So he'll schedule the whole day like this. So he'll basically get to go do whatever he wants except for 5 minutes at the end. And he says, inevitably, he said, I shouldn't tell you this because it's giving it away, but inevitably you will find yourself working longer than 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So you just, the forcing yourself to show up, I think, it's a huge motivator to get you going. It's just showing up, you know, and even when you feel down, it's amazing how much of this is emotional, you know, that the work, what seems like technical work, is actually really driven by emotion. Like, how into this am I? And so by forcing yourself to just show up and do a little bit and then kind of seducing yourself into keeping going, I think it's a good trick.
That's true. It is. It really is.
I'm not sure that's the best advice I've ever heard in my life, but that's what's coming to me right now.
I've gotten it a few times, actually, this showing up thing. So there's definitely something in it, for sure.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But one quick thing. I know you do voices. And I was wondering if you can take a line out of something that you've done before and do a voice.
Let's see. Well, I was the dad in Monsters who just says, good night, kiddo. let's see. What else have I done?
You've done some stuff. You played Mr. Incredible at one point, didn't you?
Yeah, I was this sort of cheesy 60s television version of Mr. Incredible. And that was kind of the same voice I did for, because I was doing Buzz Lightyear for Scratch when we were building it. So that was just like, I'll help you, eager young space cadets. You know, it's kind of like a superheroish thing. And then, if you've seen the trailer for Inside Out, I'm the voice of Dad's anger.
So cool.
At the mustache. Yeah. That's me too. So awesome. I don't know what I say. I don't remember any of the lines from that off the top of my head, but
I remember being very, I can relate to it so much in my own dad and my uncles. I'm like, that is so manly.
What did she say?
I can't remember what he said, but I remember thinking, yep, that's so lifelike, you know, so relatable.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, I have to let you go, but I want to say thank you so much because I know you've been crazy busy and you gave me more time than I was allotted, so.
I hope some of this is useful and helpful.
It is. I'm afraid I was so nervous. I don't know if Mark told you how nervous I was going to be. He told me not to be, but I can't help it. I'm only feel like I'm starting to relax now, but there you go. Such is life.
Well, hopefully I'll get to meet you, you know, in person someday, maybe at Sony or...
I'm sure we'll meet again.
Good luck to you as you start.
Thank you.
Okay, thank
Take
you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.